Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad. I have the pleasure of talking with another innovator today, Eric Rose. He's developed new products in many sectors, including consumer, healthcare, and industrial products. He is an inventor with over 80 patents, teaches innovation at Pepperdine, and is certified as a new product development professional, the MPDP certification. And for those in Southern California near Sherman Oaks, he also manages the Inventors Mastermind Meetup for sharing invention experiences. Eric, thanks for being with the Everyday Innovators today.
Good morning, Chad.
Glad you're here. Let's just dive right into your experience. So a lot of background in product development. Where did you first get involved with creating new products?
Well, it's interesting, Chad. I actually grew up in the industrial community of Cleveland, Ohio, where I started in creating products in wood shop, machine shop, metal shop. Even by the time I was 17, I was running an electro-discharge machine. From there, I was able to move on and get my industrial design degree from Arizona State, where I learned the fine art of creating new products. And when I got out of college, I joined in 1980 American Hospital Supply, designing and developing disposable medical devices that would end up in cardiac facilities, operating rooms for respiratory therapy, even urological products.
Great experience. I run into quite a few people that either got their start or are currently working in the medical device industry. Certainly seems growing and great experience to get.
Yeah, it was great.
You've also worked in lots of other places. So companies we certainly would recognize, Mattel, Interlink Electronics, indeed those medical equipment companies, a company called Moldex Metric, I had to look up, does industrial safety equipment. What was a project in your background where you learned the most about new product development? I want to hear a story that stands out to you.
Sure. Well, I had the good fortune of being able to work on a team at Mattel Toys called Intel Play. And what happened was the chief executive officers of both Intel and Mattel got together at a corporate growth conference and thought, well, wouldn't it be cool if the two companies could get together and work on a new product line for smart toys? And that's, in fact, what happened. And I was able to come on board kind of as a product engineering manager and integrate the team activities. And one of the great stories I love telling is the Intel Play digital video microscope called the QX3. And that product became the best-selling technology toy of Christmas 1999.
And back up to what is a smart toy?
Well, that's a great question. What is a smart toy? There's no industry standard per se. But the mission for the smart toy line, the Intel Play line at Mattel at the time, was really to harness the power of the PC. So the toy itself didn't have to have a lot of brain power, not a high-powered microprocessor on board of the toy, but through the USB connection, we were able to harness the power of the PC and turn that relatively dumb toy into a smart toy through the power of the PC. One of the first really USB-connected toys that the company had ever offered.
So then was this a telescope that the image you could see on the computer through the USB connection? Was that how it worked?
Right. So it was actually a microscope.
Oh, sorry. I said telescope. Yes, microscope.
Yep. No worries. So it was conceived by the industrial design group by simply gluing a webcam on top of a standard laboratory microscope. And that was the aha moment of wouldn't it be cool if we could change the play pattern of the way the kids interact with a microscope from being a one-on-one experience, one student, one microscope, to a team activity where now the imagery out of the microscope is projected on the computer screen and everybody can get around the screen and enjoy the cool things happening on the stage of the microscope.
Hmm. So the early concept was just tested by existing microscope and glued on the little viewing device.
Love those cut and cobble kind of mock-ups.
That works. And I'm curious about the kind of the user design experience there too. When you do prototypes like that, at least this one, do you bring in kids to get feedback on the prototype, or how do you get that customer reaction?
Yeah, definitely. There were a number of focus groups that were run with kids to watch how they interfaced with the physical product, how they interfaced with the software application, what excited them, what confused them, what caused them to interact with each other and become, you know, a wonderful little group of play pals rather than, you know, that old one-on-one experience.
Mm-hmm. I would think Mattel has pretty mature tools for this, and I don't know what they do. You know, like P&G has their facility set up where they bring in often mom focus groups to review new concepts. How does Mattel do that?
Yeah, they do it in a very similar way. They'll actually have the mirror. They'll be able to see what's going on. They'll be able to query, if need be, with an independent facilitator who's in the room, certain questions that we might want to ask. So all of that is very well set up. And in this particular case, some of the fundamental knowledge from Mattel running focus groups with kids was transferred to the Skunk Works Smart Toy Lab, which was stationed in downtown Portland, where nobody really knew what it was or where it was, but it was ultimately the place where the focus group work with the kids transpired.
Oh, how fun. Portland, Oregon?
Yep.
Great. It's a fun and eclectic place to be.
Yeah, especially in the downtown community.
Yep. I think they still have the largest bookstore in Northern America there. This huge old warehouse, which is just great fun to roam through. So, so this microscope, you know, often we learn a lot from actually what went wrong on a project. And I've never been on an innovation project yet where everything worked the way we expected. So what were the bumps that you ran into along the way?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges coming in and trying to help the team move the concept into production was really the sourcing. Trying to find a supplier, inevitably in Asia, who would integrate all the subsystems and had some level of experience with the technology was quite difficult. So I took many trips deep into China, looking at camera factories, binocular factories, to see whether they'd be able to integrate the technology. And while they had some of the fundamental ability to produce the key components, they were new suppliers to the Mattel operation system. And ultimately, all of that effort was essentially thrown out the window because they weren't in the Mattel approved supplier system. So what we ended up having to do is retrench, go back to the approved supplier system, find a supplier who didn't have necessarily the optics integration expertise, but had the fundamental quality control, manufacturing processes and systems in place, reporting systems, and then bring them up to speed on how to produce such a technologically oriented optics-based system. So that was quite a challenge, and we lost a fair amount of time being able to try to integrate them. And of course, Christmas never moves, so you can't be late to Christmas. And it was quite a challenge to pull it off regardless.
That's a pretty strong milestone that's stuck in the ground, Christmas.
Yes.
Yep. So it sounds like you were working first to try to find the best solution to, in terms of the best integrator to pull off putting this product together, and then ran into this organizational hurdle of needing an approved sourcing, approved vendor to do the work for Mattel.
Correct. Right.
Okay. Had you ran into this before, that organizational clash? I'm curious if there was something that you thought you could find a supplier that would work, or was this finding out about that you needed to be on the approved list? Did that come later?
It really came later. We found a new supplier for the lenses themselves, a great domestic molder in the Southwest, and really compared their ability and cost and quality against some Asian suppliers. And we just found out that the best solution for that one element was a new non-approved supplier in the Southwest. We were able to get them approved because they weren't the complete system integrator. Mm. They were just a component supplier. So we actually molded these custom lenses for the microscope in the Southwest and then shipped them over to China for integration at the approved supplier's location.
Okay. So there was an exercise that you did go through to get a supplier approved for the lenses.
Yes.
And then had to really, it sounds like, educate and train an existing supplier that was approved to pull off integrating this new product.
Yeah, well, yes. And one of the other key things we had to do with this Chinese supplier was we built automated test equipment in the U.S. that allowed them to put the microscope into the system. And with the software and hardware that we built in the U.S. and shipped to them, it pretty much just gave them green light, red light, whether the image quality, the focus, the lens quality, all of that was integrated into the automated test equipment. So the Chinese supplier pretty much had a red light, green light scenario at the end of the production line.
Okay, very good. I think for the everyday innovators listening, this is a good example of the organizational hurdles that get in the way of product managers some of the time that we might take for granted that they really have a pretty big impact on actually getting the project done. And,
yes.
And this issue of, you know, hey, if the organization says you have to work with approved suppliers, you have to work with approved suppliers.
Yep.
Okay. Very good. So tell us the unraveled the success story. You kind of alluded that this was a bestseller. What were the things that you would say went really right leading up to making this a success?
Sure. Well, I think there were a number of them. First of all, both companies were very savvy in picking a limited number of people to bring into the Smart Toy Lab and to be able to then create a Skunk Works environment in downtown Portland, where the Mattel product designers were located, the Mattel software development people were, and the Intel firmware engineers, some of the mechanical guys, were all located there. And then I was the liaison between the corporate office in Los Angeles and the Smart Toy Lab in Portland, typically spending about a week a month up in the Portland area for about a year. The integration of the two teams, the Mattel team and the Intel team, really went very well. It took a lot of effort from a lot of people to be able to integrate all the functions. You've got the hardware and the software and the firmware. You had an imaging module being developed in the UK. You had product design being done in Portland and some in Los Angeles and some in the Southwest as it related to the optics. You had some of the product design being done in Hong Kong at the Mattel Development Center there. Trying to integrate all of these different pieces went very well. We went from that first cut and cobble model of a webcam glued on a microscope to launch into the market in about 1 year. It was a team of about 50 people in total, and the integration was really quite a success story.
And that's a good number of people to coordinate and try to integrate. What do you think were the elements there that made that integration work? Because so many times you put partnerships together with people working from different companies on a project, and you don't, you know, that's really what kills the what could have been a success was the problems that occur with the two companies working together.
Sure. Well, I think a couple things worked very well. Number one, physically co-locating the Mattel creative folks, both on the product design and the software side, with the Intel staff that handled a lot of the higher level technical issues, image processing, data collection, etc. All of that, those roles were integrated into the Skunk Works in Mattel's Smart Toy Lab in Portland, all under one roof. And that went very well. And then I was given the free rein to be able to work with all the different groups across the globe to be able to manage that program and make sure everybody was on the same page day in and day out.
So that Skunk Works approach where everyone came together physically in the same building, the two companies there, the employees working with each other, was that a model that had been used before on other projects that people at Mattel had experience with, or was this kind of new?
Yeah, I had never seen that done at Mattel. I never heard anybody talk about it being done at Mattel. I think Intel had a little more of that because they have a kind of a research and development laboratory, a facility where they do a lot of blue sky work, and it's off from the main campus. But really taking two different companies and bringing their expertise in-house under one roof clearly was a new approach.
Mm-hmm. Did that come back and impact Mattel's culture in any way? Did you see this approach being used in other products?
Not directly, but indirectly. What happened thereafter was the corporation, Mattel, came up with a project at the time. They called it the X Team, where they brought a number of people together from R&D and marketing and operations and went off site. We actually went to a product design school in the LA area and stayed there for 6 weeks in a Skunk Works environment, looking at how the company was developing products, what we could do better. And the specific task that we did was looking at what we could do to improve the Barbie brand and the Barbie product offering. And we did that in an offsite Skunk Works, and it was very similar to some of the offsite Skunk Works activities that had gone on with the Intel Playline.
Wow, you know, talking about being a kid in a candy store. That mm-hmm. just sounds like such a for a product designer. I would think that would be such a fun experience to be able to be in that environment for 6 weeks with people focused on product.
Yes. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And we got to do a lot of field trips going out to elementary schools and watching kids play. And it was a great experience.
Very good. And I want to make sure we underscore this issue of the Skunk Works made this successful and how many times that this just doesn't work out. And I don't know if you have other examples from your experience that you can point to just help emphasize that we often work with partners and we don't see this kind of success.
Well, one of the things I've seen over the years is that the new product development team are often great technical experts to the fundamental operations of the business. And those staff members who are those new product experts will get drawn away from the future work of the company, that being the R&D, the new product innovation, and they'll get pulled into crises because the production line went down. And there's some supplier problem, some quality problem, some manufacturing problem. And they'll say, well, who can handle this on an emergency basis? And it'll be R&D. And so R&D will be, unfortunately, pulled off their new product innovation work, put on what I call sustaining engineering. And then the growth plans for revenue in the future get waylaid because they get pulled off. So over the years, when I've been managing new product development groups, I've lobbied hard to have sustaining engineering be a fundamental staff function so that the R&D folks can focus on the future of the company and the revenue of the future of the company.
Yeah, to separate that out. I like that phrase, sustaining engineering, because I always think of it as firefighting. And I know there's more involved in sustaining engineering, but it's those fires that come up that pull away product developers, product managers, and they unfortunately get caught up in very tactical issues that are urgent and important, but it doesn't allow them to do their job, which is really focused, as you said, on that future revenue of the company.
Right.
Very good. Well, thanks for sharing the examples there and some of your experience. And I want to dive into an article that you wrote. I know you're always contributing to the field of new product development through your teaching and consulting and writing. And you wrote this article for Visions, a trade magazine published by PDMA. And the article is titled Managing NPD Project Trade-Offs. What did you want to do by getting that article put together? What were you trying to address?
Well, sure. Over the years in managing new product development, what I found is that people would refer to the classic triad of schedule, scope, and budget when managing projects. But I got to learn pretty quickly that that limited triad was kind of naive in terms of what really was going on in a new product development project and what were the key attributes that had to be managed. So I decided to look at it differently and broke out what budget really meant. And the way I saw it, Chad, was that budget really meant product cost, development cost, and capital cost. So now I've taken those three costs, added it to the feature set and the schedule, and created what I call the NPD Project Pentagon, where again, you've got the features, the product cost, the capital equipment cost, the development cost, and the schedule. And you'll manage those five key attributes during your product development project. That's really the message I wanted to get across in this article, to think more broadly about how to manage an NPD project.
So were you seeing a limitation in product success or how the metrics were being applied to determine product success by using that kind of standard, the triangle of project management of looking at scope, budget, schedule?
Yeah, I think more often than not, what would happen is I'd find the chief financial officer arguing with what was defined as a successful new product launch. So, for example, the product might have met its product cost targets, the feature set, the schedule, but the development cost went over budget, or the capital cost had never been budgeted to be that high in plant and equipment and tooling. And so often I would hear from the chief financial officer of the company that, yeah, well, we made it out on time and our product margins are there, but wow, did we run over budget in the non-recurring expenses of R&D and capital equipment. And so that really drove me to come up with this NPD Project Pentagon, looking at the five critical attributes and saying we need a better way of handling how we manage NPD projects.
Okay. I think some examples will help make this applicable. Why don't we dive into some of the key trade-offs that you see being important for product managers to think about?
Sure. Well, there's lots of trade-offs to look at. You know, when I published the article, I listed several ways of trading off everything from features to schedule, features to cost. Product cost versus capital equipment cost is classic. When you look at, let's say, increasing the capacity of capital equipment, such as molds, of course, you'll drive down the product cost, but then your capital cost goes up. One of the stories I like to talk about is features versus schedule. Schedule is often critical. Again, I come back to the toy business. I was working on a project called a Winnie the Pooh spinning walker. One of the key attributes was that Winnie the Pooh sat on a turntable and had to spin when the child would push the walker. And of course, we wanted that product to work on any surface, whether it was linoleum or carpet, wood floors. But again, Christmas never moves. You can't tell Walmart you're going to be late and not have the product available. So during the development, we built several prototypes, only to find out that Winnie the Pooh didn't spin quite as reliably as we wanted to on slick floors. But with the schedule the way it was, we had no more time to iterate and improve the quality and reliability, long-term reliability of Pooh spinning on the product. Now, it was certainly safe and had its level of effectiveness, but just didn't have quite that last 10 or 20% performance that we wanted. But the schedule was king. Christmas doesn't move, and the product had to launch. And that's the decision ultimately we ended up making.
Right. So going into a product development cycle like that, these possible trade-offs that could be made, are the key drivers clearly known to the product team? Like in this case, it was the schedule. Is that typical?
Yeah, the schedule, in that case, the schedule was king. In the medical industry, and I've worked a number of years in the healthcare field and have a number of clients today who are physicians, and I help them bring new products to market. Their passion is really about the quality of the product, the feature set of the product, and they're less driven about a schedule, a deadline, a commitment for a particular date, such as Christmas. That's not what's important, particularly in the healthcare field. It needs to be safe and effective. And generally speaking, going in, we have the fundamental understanding of what are the key drivers. Inevitably, when you're in a new product development project, there are things that you just don't even know you don't know. And you'll discover those things, and you'll have to make some decisions on the fly about those trade-offs. But with the NPD Project Pentagon, it's a great framework to look at how to manage those trade-offs.
And make the trade-off decisions in a more educated manner.
Yes, definitely. Eyes wide open.
Yep. So we often face constraints as we're working on actual products. And one way to view those constraints is they're incredibly frustrating and they limit what we want to do. And another way to view them is that creates that healthy tension that sometimes actually leads to better innovations. And that tension lets us break through some barriers and we're able to put things together in new ways. And as you're talking about these trade-offs, I am thinking in my head of them as in terms of constraints that you have to balance one off the other. Is that not the right way, or is that an okay way to be thinking about it?
Yeah, you're right on, Chad. You do have to balance these constraints against one against the other. And one of the techniques that I suggested in the article that I wrote is to actually force rank some of the key attributes in the product, particularly the most important key attributes. And if you can literally force rank them on a table, mm-hmm. and look at, for example, the key elements, what their product cost contributions are, and then map those contributions against the percentage cost of that element to the whole product. You know, I have one example in the article where I talk about one of the independent features is a status display in the product. And that status display is over 51% of the product cost. But yet, if you query your stakeholders who are making the decisions about what the product is, customers, distributors, key opinion leaders as stakeholders, and the stakeholders ultimately have you force rank that status display as, let's say, feature 4 out of 5 in terms of priority. So it's nearly at the bottom, but it's over 50% of the product cost. Those kind of decisions are easy then to say, you know what, that status display probably isn't necessary, particularly in light of how expensive it is in the product cost. And then that attribute will be cut from the feature set. So I think being able to force rank the feature set in terms of the value to the stakeholders and use that as a tool to look at the trade-offs is a great way to manage.
Yeah, absolutely. Breaking it down by the specific attributes. And it reminds me a little bit of the Kanna model that looks at that. And maybe I can find a picture to put in the show notes for what this thing is. But, you know, on two dimensions, we look at those features that customers don't really expect, that if they're there, they delight the customers and they really make it a special product. Mm-hmm. Or those features that we look at and go, well, yeah, they expect them to be there and, you know, they contribute to the overall all value of the product. And those features that, yeah, you know, they don't really matter so much to the customer. And this forced mm-hmm. ranking helps to identify some of that and say, you know, these might be elements of the product that are associated with increased capital costs or product planning costs that don't really offer the value that they're worth.
And then when you take the time to go through that analysis, you will delight the chief financial officer of the company, you know, as well as potentially the chief marketing officer, because he often has P&L responsibility as well.
Absolutely. You know, so if you're doing a good job still providing customer value, solving their problem, delighting them, and in the process generating more profit, hopefully this makes its way back to you too as the product manager in the form of a bonus or promotion or something.
Yeah, that'd be great.
That would be great. We'd like to see that when that happens. Very good. Anything you want to wrap up with in terms of the trade-offs there?
No, I think we've covered it. I think using that pentagon, the five-sided image there, I think works well. It also works well for people who are not necessarily new product innovators, but want to have an understanding of what new product innovators do. And I found that to be very effective. So coming back to the NPD Project Pentagon is a great way to manage a new product development project.
Great. And you have that article linked from your website, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I'll provide a link to that in the show notes. And why don't you just share your website for anyone listening that just wants to go there now?
Sure. It's ericpaulrose.com. That's ericpaulrose.com.
Great. Thank you very much. And again, Everyday Innovators, look for the show notes and I'll give you a link right to that article. And I always like to ask my guests about an innovation or success quote that has particular meaning to them. So what is the one you chose and why did you choose it?
Well, sure. I love to say proper prior planning prevents poor performance. And, you know, besides being a great alliteration, it really does speak to, in my mind, what makes a successful new product development project. And it's all about, you know, identifying, let's say, the issues in the fuzzy front end, identifying resources, identifying, you know, the key attributes that you're trying to deliver to the market. What kind of budgets do you have? So it's all about the proper prior planning preventing poor performance in a new product development project.
Very good. And I've never been good at tongue twisters, and this one sounds like one to me a little bit, but I'm going to try it just to help me remember it. Proper prior planning prevents poor performance.
Well done, Chad.
Thanks for sharing that with us. And just in terms of wrapping up the interview with you, want to make sure that this interview is a win for you. What do you want to leave with our listeners and any information in terms of them following your work that you want to share?
Sure. Well, first of all, I want everybody to, and who's a new product innovator, just, you know, be aware. New product development, project management is really a discipline, and it's best managed with a broad perspective from looking at from many stakeholders, end users, distributors, key opinion leaders, just a wide variety of stakeholders, and it's best managed when it's integrated with the product management function and managed with eyes wide open.
Absolutely.
I can be reached both on my website. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Eric Paul Rose.
Very good. And again, I'll put those in the show notes.
Wonderful.
Eric, thanks for sharing the examples with us, some of your past experiences developing products. You have deep product development experience, and also that article making project trade-offs.
My pleasure.
And Everyday Innovators, again, appreciate you listening. If you are finding value in these podcasts, please go to iTunes and go ahead and leave a recommendation or review of this. If you're not finding value in it, please email me and give me ideas on how we can make this better. You can contact me through the website, theeverydayinnovator.com. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training Your Customers Will Love You For. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.